session number 28353, reel 14.
You were drawing the distinction, or making the comparison between the civil service and the military service.
The civil service have a structure which does allow them to get performance-related pay, and in extremis, the really high flyers and high performers will, in any one year, get an up to a 10% pay rise. And therefore, those in the civil servants were certainly had the ability to be outpaid significantly vis-a-vis their single service opposite numbers. And that has put great pressure on senior service chiefs to accept a performance-related pay award for not only the Armed Forces Pay Review Body, but also the senior salaries review personnel. It's never going to quite match the civil service. Equally, there aren't that many civil servants getting 10% either. Again, there'd be very few, but there'll be quite a lot getting 4 or 5% performance-related pay things, which will have, again, an effect of outstripping their single service counterparts. My objection to performance-related pay within the military is, how can you compare, on the one hand, the performance, shall we say, of a two-star working in the central staffs of MOD versus a divisional commander put in charge of an operation in Iraq or something? How can you possibly compare their two performances? I think it's almost impossible. Equally, how do you set objectives for your operational commander at the beginning of the year for him to meet, because it's, again, his task during that year may change fundamentally, and he may have to suddenly ditch everything else to do this. So at the end of the year, yes, he's met a new objective that you didn't set him at the beginning of the year, but he's entirely failed on the others because he just hasn't had time.
Yeah.
So very, very difficult, I think, to set objectives properly for military people in the round. And therefore to come to an objective comparison of performance. Equally, I have real grave concerns about transparency. I think one of the great strengths of the military system has been that our pay at every level has been totally transparent to everybody else within the service. If a private soldier has wanted to and bothered to look up, he used to be able to see precisely what his divisional commander was being paid. And all right, it was a lot more than he was being paid, but he could see what it was. Now he can't. He has no idea, really. He just knows that he's paid somewhere between there and there. And equally, there'll be some mention in the text which says that there's performance-related pay. And the suspicious in the armed forces will think that the senior officers have got their snouts in the trough and that they're getting a better deal than anybody else. In the same way, frankly, as because there has been a lack of transparency in civil service pay, there's a lot of military people who think that all the civil servants have got their snouts in the trough. Now, because I had responsibility for pay and to a degree for civil servants as well, I know that that's not the case, although I do know equally there are who year on year are getting quite, you know, substantial pay rises. But it's not general across the whole of the civil service, but there's a lot of service people who think that they do. And I say, so I was against performance related pay across the services in a major way, but without it, the services were going to increasingly fall behind their civil service and commercial, industrial, banking type counterparts. But back to your sort of thing about the five-star rank, yes, I mean, I think what you say is true, but I don't think it was easily justifiable in this day and age, sadly.
Right. Thank you.
Now, if we can move away from the personnel function and move on to the logistics responsibilities of the DCS P&P, as I said, he used to chair the Principal Administrative Officers Committee The members of which were him as chairman, CNC Logistics Command for the Air Force, Chief of Fleet Support for the Navy, and Quartermaster General for the Army. Again, a four-star committee chaired by a three-star officer, which didn't make it particularly easy. As well as that responsibility, I also had the Assistant Chief of Defence Staff Logistics working for me, who provided logistics advice to CDS for operations. So he had a small staff in the centre who advised the CDS on logistics support for operations. I suppose that the one real issue which confronted the PAO committee... the issue which really confronted me as chairman of the PAO's committee was the whole issue of aircraft repair. And this again sort of goes back to, as I say, the aftermath of defence cost studies, where it was thought that RAF Third Line was too expensive, should be privatised and so forth. And what we were asked to do was to go away and find the best way of providing deep servicing support for the three services, and the suggestion that we should have a defence aircraft repair agency, largely contractorised. And at the end of the day, that was the solution that came out of it, but the degree to which it became totally civilianized and outside the sort of the control of the three services came about because the three services couldn't agree. Clearly we needed a repair agency. I managed to get the three PAOs to agree that that's the way we should go. Although the Air Force were reluctant to have any contractorization, I persuaded the CNC of Logistics Command that there had to be some move on that. We couldn't totally turn our face against it, provided our deployable capability was maintained with sufficient uniformed people within this organisation to deploy if required. So I got him to accept that. The Army agreed that they would throw their helicopters into this particular pool, and it could be under Royal Air Force command, so it would be an agency directly responsible to CNC Logistics Command, but the Navy wouldn't. The Navy would not agree that the Air Force should command this, and so although we've come to a position within my committee where two of the three PAOs agreed, and I as the chairman agreed, the Navy Chief of Fleet Support would not agree, and he raised it to chiefly level. So having had this great debate within the PAO committee, it then got raised to the Chiefs of Staff level, and the First Sea Lord of the day would not put up with it, and so the whole thing stalled. Eventually ministers ruled that we would have the Defence Aircraft Repair Agency, and so it was resolved almost along the lines that I and two of the PAOs had wanted. But what it did do was it actually frustrated certain elements of the Ministry of Defence that the three services wouldn't agree, and it certainly frustrated ministers, so that when we came to the defence review of 97-98, it gave ministers the grounds for saying we will go to a Chief of Defence Logistics and take all of logistics support, deep logistics support, away from the three services and give it to a Chief of Defence Logistics answering directly to the Chief of Defence Staff in the centre. And I'm quite sure that they used that. So, you know, look how you argued and bickered over not setting up something as simple as the Defence Aircraft Repair Agency. You can't get yourselves organised. We'll sort it out for you, and we'll set up the Chief of Defence logistics against the wishes of the three single service chiefs. And that was, I think, the single services behaving at their worst, frankly. It was a great shame. They could have got on, if they'd got on and agreed to this Defence Aircraft Repair Agency in the first place, I think we might have done away with the Chief of Defence Logistics during the Defence Review.
And who was the first Sea Lord of the day at the time?
The first Sea Lord of the day, it was Slater. The Chief of Fleet Support was a chap called Dunt. And as I say, I don't know quite why, whether he was under marching orders, I don't know. But he just refused to accept it. And so it all got raised, the whole argument went round again in chiefs, whereas we ought to have been able to sort it out at a much lower, or not much lower, at a lower level. The other area where we were doing work, which was difficult again because all three services were at different stages, was on IT support for logistics, to try and get a greater degree of commonality in the way in which the three services ran the IT support, so that again there was greater commonality, so that we, when we went on operations, again there was a better chance of the Chief of Joint Operations being supported on a logistics point of view, because we had one IT system for doing it, whereas, as I say, all three services had different IT systems at different levels of capability, with the Navy and the Air Force probably some distance ahead of the Army, whose, frankly, sort of logistics support structure was not particularly sound and had not been properly resourced. And I think that probably brings me then to the Strategic Defence Review of 97-98. Something that was badly needed, because there's no doubt that by this time we had got ourselves badly out of kilter with what was required. We had had the defence cost studies as the Conservative government's response to the peace dividend brought about by the collapse of communism. A structure and a way of operating which did not prove to be what was required, because 91-92 everybody supposed that peace was going to break out, that we weren't going to get a whole heap of operations and things of that nature, therefore you could reduce the size of the front line substantially, you could contractorise out a lot of the non-core tasks, and yet suddenly we found ourselves in a position where actually we were deploying far more regularly on operations than we had for many years previously, and therefore our structures, strengths and so forth totally out of kilter, and the need to do a defence review. And we knew that there was an election coming up and the chances are that we'd have a change of government. So wisely, before that happened, the MOD ministers commissioned a paper to be written, which was a paper on looking at the foreign and security policy of the United Kingdom. So a joint study done between the MOD and the Foreign Office to produce this baseline paper, which would be used as the foundation of a defence review which was almost certain to follow an election. And we got that paper written in 90, so starting in 96, it running into 97, available then as soon as the Labour government came into power, to be the baseline against which a defence review was done. And it was a real strength, because the Cabinet, although they didn't endorse it as a paper, they noted and signed it as an appropriate basis for a defence review, and it therefore set the foundations for that defence review, which was an extremely good, coherent process. And I think the SDR of 97-98 will stand out as one of the very good reviews done within the MOD and outside, in as much that you could empirically trace it through from that baseline security and foreign policy paper through the defence planning assumptions, etc., etc., to a force structure which was specifically designed to meet your aims. The way in which it was done was that, again, all the various work strands were headed up at the sort of two-star level, so all sorts of two-stars from inside the building and outside were each given an area to go away and look at to come up with the answers for structure and modus operandi out of the defence costs, defence review, strategic defence review. But as I say, having got the policy paper, we then looked at the defence planning assumptions, things like scale of effort, concurrency, recuperation from operations and so forth. And once we got all those in place, you could then empirically work out the size of your force structure required. At the end of the day, we had to make certain compromises in force structure in order to meet the profile of money that we had in the programme, and we probably did accept at the end of the day a deficit in terms of the defence allocation of money of something in the order of £500 million a year. We probably needed more than that. We thought we were going to get what we needed. At the last moment, the Treasury said, I'm sorry, it's this or nothing. And I think it probably was right to accept it, although you could argue the other way. But if we hadn't accepted the amount of money that they came up with, then I think we'd have had to go through the whole process again, and people have just got sick and tired of the review process. And so I think the view was, right, accept what we've been given. It will bring pressures in due course, but we can live to fight another day. But it wasn't a huge sum of money. It put us under pressure, but it wasn't a huge sum. But at least we had got, an empirical way of saying that's why we've got to that force structure, because of these defence planning assumptions, which is based on that policy paper. And that was the first time we'd had that for ages. First time we'd had it in my experience at all. Whereas previously we didn't have that solid basis. And so every year the Conservative Party had given us almost a mini defence review, but there was no, you couldn't say, I'm sorry, you can't do that, because if you do that, we can't do this. But now we could, and it was actually a very secure outcome, even if we didn't have quite the money we needed to sustain it, and that's why they've had to go back into it and look at it again subsequently and re-evaluate the defence planning assumptions and so forth.
So are you referring to the recent re-evaluation that's just taken place?
Yes.
So that has taken place really because it wasn't possible due to the Treasury to get it right.
Things had changed again slightly in the aftermath of the 11th of September 2001 and the emergence then of international terrorism as a real threat. Then clearly we had to re-look at the planning assumptions in the first place. And one or two of the planning assumptions, which I think we got wrong in 97-98, were that we restricted our geographical focus too close to the United Kingdom and Europe. So we had said that, we were looking at the areas of importance were the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and the North African littoral. And that was as far as we would frankly look in terms of our geographical compass. Post 9/11, we decided we needed to look further. So we needed to go probably at least as far as the nearer parts of the Far East. Not as far as Singapore and Malaysia, but certainly as far as Nepal and that sort of area. Further down into Africa, we would need to look to protect our interests. And so that was one change of planning assumptions. Clearly the homeland defence was another thing that we had not looked at in 97-98 to the degree that we needed to. So a number of our planning assumptions needed to change. So that required work to be done. And the fact that we didn't have enough money in the programme in the first place required work to be done. And so, yes, we've had at least one more bite at the cherry, if not two, since then. And I think it's fair to say, or I would say, although some wouldn't agree with me, that to a degree we now actually broken that very clear link between planning assumptions and force structure. I think we have taken, since the latest reviews, I think we have taken some risk against force structure in order to meet planning assumptions, in order to fund things like network-enabled capability, network-centric warfare type capabilities. In order to give us that, we've taken compromises on force structure on an act of faith that network-enabled capability will increase our effectiveness for a smaller force structure. We haven't got there, but we've taken the cuts in the force structure anyway, because unless we did, we couldn't pay for that. Now, whether you do get from there to where you want to go remains to be seen. So we've taken a slight leap of faith, I believe.
What is the time frame on that?
Well, I don't think I could put a time frame, because, you know, it's all incremental. But I mean, I think, you know, we're probably talking about 2015, that sort of time scale, probably, before many of the capabilities which should emerge from network-enabled capability really come to fruition. And in the meantime, we've taken, I think, a risk against certain elements of force structure in order to pay for that.
Can you just take 1 second and explain what network capability is?
Well, it is the ability to put precision effect and respond quickly to getting precision effect in time, at distance, against where you want it. So it is, it's the whole business of intelligence, gathering of intelligence, using sensors to be able to respond extremely quickly to events on the ground. So it is data links, it is that electronic connectivity between sensors watching what's happening, decision making, to putting targets on, or weapons on target, whether it's air launch, army or navy.
And the sensors you're referring to are satellite observation, I suppose.
Could be all sorts of. Could be space sensors, could be sub-water sensors, could be airborne but conventional, could be unmanned air vehicles, could be all sorts of things, could be people on the ground, all contributing to that connectivity which allows you to recognise what is going on the ground, to get back to decision-making, to put weapons on target, and get inside the decision-making cycle of the other person.
Right, thank you.
Right. Now, out of the SDR, clearly again a number of sort of changes, further centralisation within the MOD head office, the rebrigading now, going back to my post then, as DSS programmes and personnel, a recognition, I think, to a degree that particular post was too heavily loaded, and therefore taking away some of his programming responsibilities to rebrigade those with the systems people, what had been systems people. So the putting together of the balance of investment across defence as a whole, together with the people who actually had responsibility for the equipment plan. Now, you could see a logic to that, but also there was a fault line as well in that respect, because the systems people had never really worried or had to worry about the running cost elements of the single services, you know, the prop man and things of that nature. And now they were going to have responsibility for the balanced investment across defence as a whole, but they still weren't going to have responsibility for the day-to-day running costs. And I felt personally that put a fault line, a worse fault line, than there was under the old system. But you could argue it both ways, and I think people felt, because of span of responsibility, it was better to give the systems area more responsibility for balanced investment as a whole, even though you had this fault line then with the single services. But that was one of the results of the SDR. Further erosion of single service staff support, so a further cut in the numbers of staff that supported directly the single service chiefs. There was an attempt to raise the chief of joint operations to 4-star, which I mentioned was a concern, and that was seen off by the single services, and certainly I was against it as a member of the central staff, although there were other members of the central staff who wanted to see that happen. Certainly a greater centralisation again of the personnel function, almost a move to try and set up a chief of defence personnel who would have largely taken away the responsibilities of the Second Sea Lord, the Adjutant General and CNC Personnel and Training Command, but that was prevented. What wasn't prevented was again a greater centralisation of the training function from a policy perspective. So now under the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff Personnel there is an Assistant Chief of Defence Staff for training, and he sets the training policy against which the three services have to deliver. So a considerable centralisation there. Clearly a look at all the three single service ORBATs. So for the Royal Navy they lost frigates, submarines and minesweepers. The army changed its structure, lost quite a lot of army and armour and artillery, but got a sixth deployable brigade, which was good news for them. We looked at ground-based air defence and a coming together of the army and the air force in terms of ground-based air defence, Rapier, and as I said earlier, a far greater move to jointry, far more things done on a tri-service basis, which for the era which we're in I think is right. The services I think were generally speaking quite keen to move to that. The individual members of the services have wanted it, and I think by and large it's worked well in most areas, although there has been some sacred ground. Numbers of RAF aircraft clearly came down substantially. What I think we did manage to do was convince people beyond any doubt that the Tornado F3 program aligned to the Typhoon program was right, and we have obviously removed any chance of going to what Walker was talking about earlier and replacing the F3 with F-16s. I think the two major jointry things, well I suppose there were three really, that was the setting up of the Joint Helicopter Command, and that actually came from the services themselves, not from politicians. This was something that we wanted to do because we could see that we, across the services as a whole, we had lots of different helicopters, all supported differently, often operating together, but more expensively than it needed be. So the formation of the Joint Helicopter Command, I think, a very logical step. I have some reservations about it now, but in terms of operational output, certainly an enhancement, and frankly a way of saving money on helicopters, partly through rationalising on the number of types, but because we would amalgamate the support, because we would reduce the number of types, we could probably do with less helicopters than otherwise we needed. And I think the alternative of going down this route would have been to buy another 10 or 12 Chinook helicopters, for example. So that was set up, put under the operational command of the Army, but with, so far, always a Royal Air Force officer commanding the Joint Helicopter Command because of our breadth of expertise. I think, in hindsight, the one thing that I regret is that the Royal Air Force people working within the Joint Helicopter Command, and maybe the Navy helicopter pilots and people working within it also feel this way, is that their single services have cast them off. That, you know, that we've given them to the army, even though they wear blue uniforms. And I think that is something that we need to be very careful of, because clearly our support helicopter community is quite a sizable community and a real part of our capability. And I think there is just a feeling amongst our SH people that we have rather abandoned them. And I think that's something that either means we got it wrong in the first place, or we haven't addressed it properly in the gestation of the Joint Helicopter Command. But from a purely operational point of view, I have no doubt the Joint Helicopter Command is an improvement on what we had before.
We'll pause there, because we're just at the end of this tape.